Welcome to the House of Pod, a show where we pull back the curtain on the world of medicine, we answer questions about your health, and we interview great guests.
I'm Joe, and I'm not a doctor.
And I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Kaveh.
And we're two gastroenterologists.
What's a gastroenterologist?
You know, the doctors who work with your digestive system.
Say what?
You know, your liver, your pancreas, your intestines.
Where now?
Your butt, Joe. It's your butt.
Oh.
Welcome back to the House of Pod, this very special coronavirus emergency podcast number two. This is Kaveh, and I'm not here with Lizzie, but Lizzie is also here in a manner of speaking. She's on the phone. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi. Actually, I'm here in what we would consider the studio, and you are calling in because we're trying to demonstrate to our listeners really effective ways of isolating ourselves, hopefully social distancing, in a way that we can still enjoy the things that we like to do or love to do, like podcasting.
Yes, we put the social into social distancing. That is us. So Lizzie, I am glad to talk to you. And we do have a lot to go over, I think. But let's just talk a little bit about this virus and some questions that we've gotten about it. A common one that I've gotten regarding this is, why is this virus so particularly, this coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, why is this such a big deal? Why is this causing so much difficulty? What is it about this one? And it's a good question because as viruses go, we've dealt with deadlier ones, SARS and MERS, as we talked about in our last emergency podcast. They've been more dangerous. The avian flu was much more deadly, but that's also one of the reasons why this particular one is not that's not as deadly, is almost more harmful in the long run, because you can walk around with it with minimal issues. You can have minimal symptoms or no symptoms, and you can be contagious, is what it seems like. Yeah. And you can spread it to people who can be much more affected. And, you know, people weren't walking around just a little under the weather with those really bad viruses. But here, there are those people. And that's been a real issue. Right. Have you got questions like that too?
Yeah, and especially because people are feeling well and we're worried about the incubation period. And my brother just told me recently he was exposed to someone and now is worried just about what to do. Should he not see anyone? He's feeling really well. But what are the next steps? You know, that's the problem, is that people feel well, but they just don't know when to kind of reintroduce themselves into society or what to do with that information.
Yeah. This is going to be a tough one. People are asking if, you know, when we think this will be done and when we think things will come back to some normalcy. And the answer is, I don't know for sure. I think it's going to be a lot longer than we expect. I think if you listen to epidemiologists who have been talking about this and have been right from the beginning so far, seem to, all their predictions have seemed to be playing out, that they think this is going to become sort of a new seasonal disease. And
we're going to need
to have answers like that. Like, how long can you be quarantined before you say have to go out? Because this is not something that we will move past and never have to deal with again. This is something that could be like another endemic issue that we'll have, like flu, cold, and corona season.
Every year, yeah. Yeah,
so I mean, we'll need to have answers for that.
Yeah, and as far, maybe forever we'll be thinking about this like we do with the flu every year for decades. But the other thing we need to think about is just kind of now, like how long is this kind of social distancing, washing hands, thinking about wearing gloves, you know, out in the world, how long will that continue? Because let's just recap what's been going on the last week. I mean, schools are shutting down. I don't know if it's across the country yet, but it's in New York and California, and, you know, cases are rising. Ski mountains have shut down. Concerts and events are down. You know, it's just everywhere. And I told Kaveh this earlier, but I got an email from Caviar, a very well-known food delivery service, that Now I can choose the option of no contact food delivery. I got an email about that. And I'm just very curious about what the opposite of no contact food delivery is. Like, what is full contact?
You don't kiss your food deliverers on the cheek, both cheeks. That's customary.
I mean, maybe not both cheeks, but there's usually a hug or, you know, give them pounds, you know, something. There's usually something.
I know. That's a good question. I dislike caviar for many other reasons. That's a whole other story.
We're going to have a whole episode on caviar.
But it is true. I mean, getting back to sort of that point, someone also asked on Twitter there. I put a post out there about why we need to be doing social distancing, the importance of it, and why I'm upset that I don't see more of it. And they said, well, what do we do about older people who need things delivered to them? And that does seem to be the FDA's response and recommendations, which is food drop-off at the door is pretty reasonable.
Yeah.
Like, we've heard about fomites, you know, that you could leave germs on a surface and that could then be transferred to someone else. So there is that small possibility that they're touching the food, then the food's going to you. But one, if you're cooking the food, it shouldn't be a problem. If you're washing your hands well during it, it should be a low risk. So if you want to maybe say take care of an older person that needs food delivered to their home, leaving it at their door seems like a pretty good reasonable option. And yeah. I think that's what this no hug approach from Caviar is also saying.
It's a great idea. I just thought it was very amusing to get that email.
Can I tell you something that's bothering me though?
Yeah.
I posted this as well, and this is really upsetting me. I feel like there is this incredible cognitive dissonance that I'm seeing out there amongst not just people in the real world, but doctors too. I'm seeing doctors still going out to like play, like to events with other people, to parties, to like bring their kids to play with other people's kids and right. going to playgrounds and stuff. And I just don't understand, because the doctors at least know these numbers.
Right.
We know what we talked about in the last episode still seems to be accurate, which is that 40 to 70% of the world's population is going to get affected by this.
Right.
And that will be the case here in the United States. And even using conservative estimates of the death rate, that could lead to a lot of deaths.
Right. Your point is very good. We should be setting the example. And what be smart and be safe is, I do think gloves are very reasonable in public. You know, when I heard about it a couple weeks ago, I kind of thought it wasn't valid and it was too much, but I think 100%, if you can't isolate yourself entirely, I mean, grocery stores are packed, you know, they're packed. Yeah. And I would avoid public transportation and I would use gloves. Like, that's not a big sacrifice to make just to be smart. Like, just be a little cautious. Yeah. Nobody's asking you, you know, to stop using toilet paper or tampons. Like, we're just asking you to use gloves. That's okay. Right. So how do you feel, Kaveh, as a doctor, how has this affected you and your world? Because, I mean, we work in different hospitals. We're both GI. But so what's happened as far as where you work?
Yeah, I think that's something we should definitely talk about, because not just us, but all doctors are feeling, or most doctors at least, are feeling, and I think rightfully so, anxiety. It's nerve-wracking. We're hearing about stories of doctors getting sick. We're hearing lots of stories of young doctors who don't seem to have any of the medical problems getting, you know, intubated or moved to the ICU for real severe breathing problems. And that's concerning. And you could hear about stories of doctors in Italy and Iran and China all dying, from these causes, this illness, COVID-19. I mean, we're all a little stressed about it, and we're stressed about what might happen to our patients and how we're going to be able to take care of them, how the backlog of things that we might have to put off now might affect us down the road.
Right. If you think about just a routine patient for colon cancer, we're not going to diagnose it, because those patients, elective procedures are being canceled all the time now, right? This is at least for a few days, not a week. And now colon cancer that has asymptomatic won't be diagnosed for a couple months. This has real consequences, you know, like that's not a panic alarm. It's just, this is facts. And, you know, colon cancer is one of these really treatable, curable diseases, and that Kaveh and I see, you know, every month, every couple months. And thinking about all these elective things, we do screening tests so that we can catch disease before it's a problem. And that will be postponed now for a little bit, right?
Yeah. I mean, and that's something we're seeing in other parts of the world too, which is, everything's being taken up by this one problem. So people who have your everyday run-of-the-mill issues that require urgent attention and care aren't getting them. So that's one of the reasons also we have to sort of limit our ability to get in to get patients into the hospital. It's another reason why they talk about this flattening the curve and slowing the rate of the transmission through the populace. So we're not overwhelming our medical system all at one time.
Yeah.
And hopefully we have a little bit of room to still deal with the stuff that we have to normally be dealing with too.
Well, so on that note, we are going to have on the show now, Allison Friedenberg, a critical care doctor who's helping plan how to flatten that curve in, you know, the hospital she works at, a local hospital in San Francisco. So, you know, we're going to ask her a lot of questions about all this stuff.
Yeah. Before we get her on though, I wanted to discuss with you a little bit, because, you know, I know we try not to be political here. And it's not the goal of the show. It's not like something you and I are necessarily trained in. And I think actually a couple of years ago, we were relatively apolitical, but I really do believe it is hard to separate anything from politics these days. And if you're on Twitter, you're seeing a lot of criticism about the current administration and how they're handling this coronavirus pandemic. And I do want to mention something about it briefly. I mean, I will defer listeners to an episode of Robert Evans' show, Behind the Bastards, or actually Worst Year Pod. They just did an episode on the coronavirus, and they go into much better detail about the political ramifications behind what happened. But I will say this. I don't think it's fair to say that the president is responsible for what's happening. I mean, he could never have stopped it from hitting our shores, even if he did everything right. And it's not that he hasn't done some things right. I personally feel like that China travel ban was probably a good idea. I don't know if I agree with all the travel bans that have been implemented, but I think there's been some good steps. It really, in terms of what I think has really been a problem, has been in terms of the testing. That really seems to be the problem.
Yeah.
I think about two things. One, as it's been described in a couple of places already, you know, we have that National Security Council. Back in 2018, we had like this center that the health sector of it that looked at pandemics and looked at the risk of them, came to the Trump administration and said, hey, this is a real problem that we're going to face at some point. And their response was disbanded. Now, that was back in 2018. And you could say that was John Bolton, who was sort of in charge of the NSC, that was responsible for it. But still, that was, like, I think, the first step where he went wrong. And then, you know, I think since then, really, it's just been the testing, getting the testing out, not taking the WHO testing, not using international testing, trying to develop our own. That's really what I think has put us behind the eight ball here. So, I mean, I think that's all I have to say about it. Do you have anything else about that?
Yeah, no, we were definitely just behind. I think part of that was China's attempt to keep it under wraps and try to control it without looking bad. A lot of it's PR. And I don't think there's been a lot of urgency. So I would love everyone to listen to our episode with Mona Hanna Atisha about the water crisis in Flint, Michigan with lead poisoning. And that just is a great example of how, you know, you need a sense of responsibility and urgency. And there's a way to do that without panic. And I just don't know that we did that early enough. And that's it, period. You know?
Yeah.
For
yeah.
me.
All right.
Okay.
So you wanna bring on our guest and
yes.
then talk?
Yes.
All right.
Stay
Let's
tuned.
Let's do it.
Okay, on the show with us today is Allison Friedenberg. She is a pulmonary and critical care specialist in San Francisco, and she's here with me recording. Kaveh and I are doing social distancing mostly because he smells, and Allison is here because essentially we're best friends. So I see her all the time, and we live very close to one another, so it is like family. So we are being responsible. We are wearing gloves when we are outside. We are washing our hands. but she is here with me and Kaveh is not. Welcome.
I mean, I am 3 feet away.
That's true. That's true. You are.
Although the recommendation is 6.
Yeah.
So I thought about it. I was like, should I just call in from downstairs? But that seems weird.
That would be awesome. We should have done that. I don't think I can. I have the capacity for Kaveh on the phone and you on the phone. Anyway, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me. Sure. I love your show.
Oh.
I've always wanted to been on.
Oh.
To have been on.
Perhaps. Perchance.
Any of those things.
Anyway, so you're an ICU doctor. You are taking care of people who we either think have COVID or we know are confirmed COVID. How has that been for you as a doctor, and how is the environment of the hospital different now in the past month?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just, it makes everything a lot more stressful. The ICU is already a stressful environment. And I think, you know, we have a lot of people that work together as a team to take care of patients in the ICU. And so everyone having to put on a lot of equipment to go in and out of the room makes it much harder to care for patients, but also to protect each other and to protect the hospital environment, to not spread the disease within the hospital. So I think it's more stressful, and it's more time dedicated to taking care of one patient. For example, normally in the intensive care unit, there are two nurses. One nurse takes care of two patients. And right now we have two nurses taking care of one patient if they're suspected of having COVID, because it's that much work to put on and off the equipment. We call that donning and doffing, which I don't know why we call it that. It seems really old school.
I'm like, it's probably
some British word.
Antique, yeah.
But it's basically putting on and taking off your protective equipment needs to be monitored, and we want to make sure people are doing it correctly. So it definitely just adds a lot of time to taking care of patients. And everyone's a lot more stressed. You know, people are scared to go into the room. People are scared to be infected. People are scared to infect each other. So I think just the overall feeling when we're working in the ICU right now and in the hospital in general and in the outpatient setting is that I think everyone's just a lot more stressed.
Yeah. And do you think that that has negative consequence on patient care? It sounds like if you have two nurses for one patient, even if it's taking a really long time to put on this equipment, that people are accounting for the fact that maybe patient care could suffer if people are avoiding the rooms.
I think, I think we do a really good job of trying to monitor patients really closely with all of the sort of advanced technology that we have. But no doubt, like if somebody were to very quickly become unstable, it's just not possible to get into the room that quickly. So yeah. I think it for sure can impede an unstable patient receiving care as quickly. I think there are probably less people going in and out of the room in general. We want to try to avoid things that we wouldn't worry about in general, like getting more x-rays and EKGs and things like that, because every time you bring one of the piece of equipment into the room, then you have to wipe it down in the room and wipe it down when you bring it outside of the room. And mm-hmm. there was a lot of worry about contamination of equipment and then spreading that to other patients in the hospital, because, you know, we have like one x-ray machine that goes all over to the hospital, or, you know, there's multiple, but one for many patients' rooms. So we don't want to infect other patients by not adequately cleaning the equipment in between patient care encounters.
Yeah.
So along those lines, I have a couple of questions for you. One is, we hear about doctors getting sick, and we're all worried about that. Particularly, you must have that in your mind when you hear about those cases, because you're one of the doctors that's working on the front lines of this. You ER doctors, intensivists, adult medicine hospitalists, you're working on the front lines. How confident do you feel about these protective gear that you're wearing, the PPEs, as we call them, personal protective equipment? How confident do you feel in their ability to protect you? And sort of as a follow-up to that, why do you think that there are doctors getting this despite I'm assuming is pretty widespread use of them when they're available?
Yeah, I think that I think a couple things about the use of them. I think the problem is in the beginning, it wasn't clear how the virus was transmitted. So early on, there was recommendations to have a lot more aggressive PPE, like wearing N95 respirators and things like that. I guess I feel safe because I think we know a lot more now than the people, like the healthcare professionals that were working in China. They didn't know, right? They didn't know when people were coming in what they had, even. They didn't know to put on PPE, which is partly why it spread so rapidly. But I think right now we're putting on, you know, sort of almost the most extensive PPE you can wear. There's a lot of talk about getting rid of the respirator part, or the what we call N95 masks, because we don't think it's transmitted by airborne, which means really small droplets, particles. So I feel comfortable going in the room. I mean, you know, you put on all this equipment. You're putting on a gown. You're putting on a mask. You're putting on usually a bouffant over your hair, and a face shield or goggles, and then gloves. That's not such a big deal putting that on when you go in the room, but it's coming out of the room that's really stressful because you've touched things in the room. And so you want to be really careful about removing it. So I don't necessarily feel as worried about myself as I'm worried about contaminating other things. So for example, when you come out of the room, there's a very clear list of how you remove each piece of what you have on. And in between each one of those steps, you have to use hand sanitizer and put on a new set of gloves. So you're going through like maybe 5 or 6 sets of gloves just to remove like your face shield. Then you take off your gloves and, you know, use hand sanitizer, put on new gloves. Then you take off your, you know, your gown. I mean, it's like each step you're using a lot of equipment. So, and someone's watching you. You're supposed to sort of have a buddy system. And we can do all that now when we don't have that many patients. Trying to do that when your whole hospital is completely overwhelmed with patients,
right,
that's going to be a big problem.
What mask are you wearing currently?
So we've been wearing N95 masks, which are the respirator masks. That recommendation from the CDC has been lightened to, if you are out of them, we believe it is fine to wear a surgical mask. Which is interesting because then I feel like they should just, you know, change the requirements so that everyone feels safer.
Right. That doesn't sound very confident.
Yeah. I mean, everyone's wondering a lot about why they haven't actually changed that recommendation. And I think it's hard when they're still, I mean, this is a virus that was identified at the very end of, I mean, it was first happening at the end of December and it was first identified in the beginning of January. We're talking about 2 months. They've isolated and figured out what this is, which is sort of incredible. But to answer the second question about why people are getting sick, I mean, I think healthcare professionals are getting sick because I think we're being exposed to people when we don't know they have it. So I think in the outpatient world, I think our friends, our colleagues, our friends' kids, I mean, it's not like for the last month we've all been socially isolating ourselves. So I actually think that the people that are getting sick because they've been exposed to people that we weren't even necessarily worried might have it.
So you mentioned using all that equipment and the masks. And by the way, as a GI doctor in the hospital, our masks are totally gone. Like people are clearly taking them or they're just being distributed, maybe be out of need. But I think there's also a lot of people who are just really panicking and taking them home. But you say that that might overwhelm the hospital. And we're talking about hospitals' ability to care for these people. So that concept is surging, right? And everyone's at work, at least, is talking about flattening the curve. Can you talk about what these concepts are and what hospitals are doing, you know, from your personal knowledge and maybe on a bigger national scale, what you know about what needs to be done?
Yeah, I think, so just to start with flattening the curve, I think there's just been an incredible amount of posting about this on social media and it's been in the news a lot. So I think most people probably are familiar with it, but just to be clear, it's not that we're going to stop the virus from spreading, but we're going to stop the virus from spreading really quickly to a huge amount of patients that will all get very sick at the same time and show up in one hospital system and completely overwhelm it. This is what's happening in Northern Italy, and this is not what happened in South Korea. So there are places in the world that have been very good at shutting down schools, shutting down group gatherings, you know, making people try to stay home and not interact with other people. And the point of that is because there are many people who will have this virus that won't feel that sick. And if they go out to, you know, gather with other people and, you know, touch a million different things when you're out at a bar or a restaurant, and then someone else gets that virus and gets very sick and then spreads to another person, another person, another person very quickly, the next thing you know, we have 200 patients coming into the hospital who are all critically ill and overwhelming us. We don't have that many ventilators. We don't have the capability of taking care of that many patients all at once. So when you do this social isolation or social distancing, however you want to refer to it, you're really trying to reduce exposing anyone to the virus, and therefore reducing the number of patients that are going to get infected all at the same time. So that flattens it out. It makes it that there's still transmission, but it's much slower over time and won't overwhelm healthcare systems.
So the area,
Sorry, go on, Lizzie.
No, it's just the area under the curve is the same. We're just trying to change the shape of the curve. So we're still going to see thousands of cases. And you're saying just not at the same time.
Not all at once. We just cannot, we simply don't have the resources for that. And we don't, you know, on so many levels, right? We don't have ventilators. We won't have enough hand sanitizer. We won't have enough gowns. We don't have enough intensivists. I mean, it's pretty, you know, we're all preparing for what we are calling surge capacity, which means we're going to prepare our hospital for where we're going to put patients if more patients are coming in that aren't critically ill, but just a higher number of inpatients that are sick. And then where are we going to put patients who are critically ill, and how are we going to staff that? How many intensivists do we need? How many hospitalists? How many nurses? How many radiology technicians, phlebotomists, you know, environmental services? It's a huge amount of work to go into planning. How do you manage a huge amount of increase in patient volume to your hospital?
Yeah.
You know, and I want to add, we're talking about places like Italy, Iran, and China, but it's actually already starting to happen here.
If you
talk to the doctor, I mean, because of the show, people have reached out to us from places here in the country. In Seattle, it sounds horrific.
Yeah.
They're intensivists like yourself. They're exhausted. I'm sure you are too, but they're the hardest hit with COVID-19 here in the United States. And it hasn't quite reached like Lombardy levels yet over in Italy, but it's getting there. And they're starting to discuss things like, okay, at what point are we going to have to triage who gets the respirator and who doesn't?
Right.
And that is something I never want us to get to.
Exactly.
Well, that's really helpful, Allison. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Something I would like for us to sort of discuss, though, before we close up this mini episode here, is how we can address everyone's feeling of helplessness. I feel like that is something that everyone is sort of feeling right now, because there's a lot of people who aren't on the front lines like you, Allison, and they're just sort of sitting there waiting for this to hit them. Like there's this giant tidal wave of COVID coming their way. And I feel like people are just feeling kind of helpless. And I would like to maybe help with that if we could. What do you guys think? What could we recommend to people to address that?
Yeah, I think it's really important, because I think people, when they're told to stay home, feel useless, you know? And I think we should recognize how critically important dealing with that feeling of wow, staying home feels like I'm not doing anything. It's really hard to stay home. I like going out. I like going to restaurants. I like socializing. And I haven't done any of that for like the last week. And it feels really weird. But I think people need to understand how incredibly important that job is. Like, you are contributing to my safety if you do that. I don't want to be taking care of 60 to 80 ICU patients. Like, I don't want to have to figure out who's going to get a ventilator and who isn't. I don't want to have to get sick myself. And I think if people understood that doing their part by staying home and not allowing your children to have play dates, that is not social isolation, right? All my friends are talking to me like, well, what about if they have a play date and they're outside, or, you know, can we go to this place, or can we do this? Because it's so hard to keep kids, you know, entertained and occupied when they're sort of, you know, just with you. But doing those things are, I mean, you're going to save so many people's lives. Like, the problem right now is when people don't do it, like, it's really clear. I'm sure a lot of people have heard the example of in pandemic flu of 1918, the Spanish flu. The example of Philadelphia versus St. Louis. So the health commissioner in Philadelphia, there was this big parade of 200,000 people that were going to, they were going to put on, called the Liberty Parade. And, you know, it was during the time of World War I, and they didn't want to, they thought they were going to make a lot of war bond money off of this parade. So they didn't want to cancel it, even though there were more and more cases of people in the area getting sick. They didn't cancel it. They had a huge gathering like that. And by the end of the week, 7 days later, like 2,600 people had died. All 31 hospitals were completely overwhelmed. I mean, it was incredible. Same thing was happening in St. Louis. A big army base was starting to, there were a lot of patients that were getting diagnosed. And the health commissioner of St. Louis said immediately, we're going to stop schools. We're going to stop movie theaters, banned all public gathering. And they had a completely different outcome. Like, they had almost no deaths. Many less people were infected. So I think, I mean, it's not that we're just making this up, right? We have evidence that this actually works. And we have evidence even within this own pandemic already that it's working. It's working in certain countries that are doing it. So I think it's incredibly important for the next several weeks for people to realize that the way you are helping us in the, as healthcare workers is to stay home and not interact with other people. I know that's not a great answer, but I think that's the absolute, like, 1 through 10, what people can do.
No, that's exactly what I think too. It is, people have to look at this like wartime. In
yeah.
And this country has come together in times of wartime in amazing ways. And it's like the sacrifice we're asking people to make isn't quite the same as we ask their grandparents to make. We're not like asking you to go to war.
Right.
We're not asking you to go to a foreign country, drop out of a plane, crawl through the mud and shoot people. I'm asking you to stay home and watch more Netflix.
Exactly. So yeah, I know. And I guess I just want to add that I think, you know, I have friends in the Midwest. You know, I grew up in the Midwest. I have friends on the East Coast. I trained on the East Coast. There are people everywhere. And as soon as it starts hitting your community, it starts to feel a lot more real. But, you know, I've heard from people in the Midwest saying, hey, do you know anyone that has it? I don't know anyone that has it. No one knows anyone that has it. This seems like a lot of craziness for nothing. We feel like this is sort of this, you know, like a media overblowing situation and creating panic. And I don't think anybody wants people to panic. I think we want people to be safe, to think about the bigger picture and to be prepared. And I think if your mentality is, I don't know anyone that has it, the answer is you don't know anyone that has it because no one's been tested. You know, a lot of people don't have that severe of symptoms when they're younger and healthier. And I think the idea that, you know, and maybe you don't have people in your community with it yet. Good. That's the way we want to keep it. And so the way to keep that from like from becoming a huge problem in your community is to do exactly what we're doing.
It is caution and urgency without panic. This is what we're trying to encourage. And there are ways to do it. And on that note, I think I love any opportunity to binge on Netflix and also to listen to our podcast over and over and over again. Thank you, Dr. Allison Friedenberg.
You're welcome.
Thanks
for having me on.
We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right.
All right. Take care, guys.
Thanks, Allison.
You bet.
And thank you to our listeners. I agree with Lizzie. Thank you so much. And also thanks to all the people following us on Twitter, interacting with us there. Like I said, that really puts the social into social distancing, and we really appreciate it. It's a great way for us to get information. We appreciate the stuff you guys are sharing with us and with other people. And thanks again for listening. Thanks, Lizzie.
Thank you.
The opinions on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and/or medical needs or concerns. All anecdotes and patient-related details have been changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible.